Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, Jim Potts back on the air. Thank you so much for joining me on your Sunday afternoon or your Sunday evening, wherever you may be. Hey, today we're going to be discussing detecting and disrupting homegrown violent extremism. That's important because I get these messages and emails from people asking about what the country is doing, et cetera, what's the government doing. So I'm going to do a small piece on that. And then after that, due to the high demand of emails on this issue of the death penalty, I mean, I brought the issue up last week, and I got a number of inquiries and comments and things of that nature. Sometimes people choose to send emails as opposed to calling in, which is fine. Some people appear to be very shy. This is a very important topic, obviously, and it came up last week in terms of active shooters, and about them getting the death penalty. And I got a lot of different emails. I had to kind of single them out a little bit. People were concerned about how long it normally takes people to be executed once they actually get that sentence. There's a lot that goes into that. You know, anytime anybody gets the death penalty, you got to understand that there's an appeal process. Whether we like it or not, that's just part of our system. And that's on a state-by-state basis, although the federal government has their own sets of rules for the appeal process and the executions of these individuals. But anyway, we're going to get into that a little bit deep. Going to give you a little history. Going to talk about some different things. Going to talk about lethal injection because I also got some emails on that as well. We'll be discussing some of the pros and cons of lethal injection as well. But meanwhile, I want to start off by sending a shout out to an email that I got from Michael from South Carolina. And he listened to me for the first time last week, and he said, "Mr. Potts, I enjoyed your show for the first time today. I met you when you came by my range in St. Helena, South Carolina, and I'll be listening from now on." Hey, Michael, I appreciate that. Michael was a good guy, and it's true. I was out there in South Carolina. He had a gun range set up on his property. It was pretty nice. It was private. Michael has a business of his own out there called Proactive Security Professionals. So anybody out there in that South Carolina area, hey, throw a little business Mike's way, and I'd really appreciate it. If you get a chance to find out where his gun range is out there, it's nice and private. He gives lessons out there as well. Okay, next email I want to talk about. Says, "Jim, you mentioned about the death penalty for active shooters on your last show. My question is, why does it take so long?" And that's kind of what I was explaining to you a moment ago. For the sentence to be carried out, it seems to take forever. They just executed a guy in South Dakota for killing a guard back in 2011. And can you shed some light on the process? Well, I kind of explained that process. That's from Tim from Texas. And I'll be getting back in a moment later on in the show regarding Texas and their executions down there. But like I said, it does take time. There's a lot of appeal processes, as you can imagine, when somebody gets the death penalty that you go through. And the attorneys for these individuals, I mean, they do their jobs. There's no doubt about it. They appeal it on the state level first based upon some issue that may be, you know, in the facts. I wrote a book called Right to Counsel back in 2008. It's still on Amazon. And that particular situation, the person was actually met the death penalty and was given the death penalty. And his appeals after we had his first conviction overturned by the California Supreme Court, his appeals after that, because they retried him, I almost hate to tell you, I'd rather have you go get the book and read it, but it was a good book. But the appeal process is an amazing process to see how long these things actually do take. But they will make an argument about maybe how they were arrested, there wasn't read their rights, or all these different things. So they appeal that. Then after they appeal that, they may appeal that they had incompetent counsel, or, you know, they go through all these different, you know, levels, if you will, till it gets up to the California Supreme Court, as an example, or the Supreme Court in your state. And then after that, if they lose that, then it goes to a further appeal to the federal courts. They start appealing through that system, you know, because it's, you know, they saying that they're being held illegally because they feel some rights have been violated. And then from there it goes to, you know, the Federal Court of Appeals. And then from there they can get into the United States Supreme Court. So that's why sometimes you hear about whether or not the Supreme Court's going to hear this. And sometimes there's a quicker way to get there, but I don't want to get into all those kind of examples. But then it goes to the, you know, United States Supreme Court. And now you hear about the guy waiting, you know, that, you know, is the phone going to ring, you know, from the United States Supreme Court or the governor's office or whatever the case may be. So it really is a long process. There's no doubt about it. These guys, when they're in jail, they have a lot of times to go. They have law libraries that they have access to. And now it's on the Internet where they see all these different cases, all these different circumstances. So it does take a while, Tim. And I will get you. I will grant you that. Next email, Jim. I heard you archived a show from last week, and you asked for us to call regarding the death penalty. I missed my opportunity, but I'm curious if the death penalty is really being used anymore. I have heard occasionally something on the news, but really don't know exactly, you know, when this happens, how many times it happens. I don't think they probably advertise it all the time. I'm just curious, to be honest with you, how long has it really been around? Michelle, Arkansas. Michelle, I'm actually going to go into this a little bit more in detail because of your email and some of the other things that were going on. I did do my research, although I had a lot of knowledge about this beforehand, but I'll address this a little bit more in detail in the show. The last email I got, Jim, I appreciate the information you give each week. Last week you discussed the death penalty, as I told you. A lot of people called in about this or contacted me, I should say. So last week, you discuss a death penalty with a caller. Personally, I think it's inhumane and barbaric. And that's sound by Barbara. So, at any rate, I'm going to be talking about some of that when I talk about the history, Barbara. And so I'll be addressing it. And there are people out there, obviously, with the pros and cons of the death penalty. There's no doubt about it. It's a very sensitive issue. It's a very private issue for some people. Having been the victims of some of these things in terms of, you know, from a family standpoint where a loved one was killed, from a political standpoint, you know, you hear about these things going back and forth and the issues with the lethal injection, you know, versus other things. So we'll be talking about some of that as well. Okay. You know, meanwhile, if anybody has any questions or want to make any comments, the number is 818-602-4929. And as you can see, people email me. They email me at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. So I always welcome the emails, even if you're a little too shy to call in. That's fine. I have no issue with that. Okay, now let's, and I'm going to talk about this first piece first and give you a chance to get your thoughts together on any calls that you might want to make. And I want to just address this issue of detecting and disrupting homegrown violent extremism because this is a major issue out there. There's no doubt about it. But let me start off by saying homegrown violent extremism is unpredictable, but it's not completely absent of warning signs, and that's what we have to understand. Now, some observers are critical that recent attacks related to homegrown violent extremism in our country have occurred because investigators had information about would-be perpetrators but missed the warning signs of imminent violence. Now, look, others rightfully contend that absent a crystal ball, some violent attacks will occur despite the best efforts of law enforcement investigators. You have to understand that. It's not an easy task. Now, we know one of the worst massacres in our history occurred, you know, in Orlando, Florida. That was way back in 2016 with Omar Manteen when he went into the nightclub and gunned down over 100 patrons, and 49 of them, I believe it was, that were killed. That was at the Pulse nightclub, just to refresh your memory. Then, of course, after that, we also had Las Vegas, which ended up then surpassing that one. And sometimes you have to think, you know, these people want, you know, their name affiliated with the worst event ever, as that individual did. But, you know, even with that Orlando incident, you know, as an example, you know, the warning signs were missed there. The FBI interviewed Mateen three times for potential ties to Islamic extremism. And, you know, you have to wonder about that, because it was on the news, as I recall, that the issue was whether or not it was the FBI that was located in the same state, in the state of Florida. So they interviewed him. But again, you have to understand that they can't determine that he's done anything wrong, that he's actually committed a crime at that time. There's nothing that you can really do. Now, there's been other incidents. I mean, you know, the Boston Marathon bombing, we had some information. Then there was the Charleston church shooting, San Bernardino shootings. You know, and it was, just to refresh your memory, there was a Fort Lauderdale attack also at the airport. And all of those instances, believe it or not, yeah, the authorities knew the perpetrator prior to the attack. And that is the sad part. But again, you can't tread on people's rights about what they think that they might do. Now, as we move through this whole issue, you have to understand that in the more recent years, considerable research has been conducted to understand how individuals become radicalized and what techniques that we can use from a law enforcement standpoint to counter violent extremism from individuals or even small groups rather than large transnational terrorist organizations like an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda as an example. Hezbollah. I mean, there's a number of them that are out there. Now, we have to also understand that law enforcement must find that probable cause for that crime. I'm going to keep coming back, you know, to that. They can't encroach on the freedoms of a person who may or may not transition from radical rhetoric into violent action. That's what you have to understand. Freedom of speech, they can say what they want to say, but you know, speech is one thing, action is something else. So, you know, we need to consider how other stakeholders in the community, like experts in mental health, should be engaged as part of a multidisciplinary effort to deter these individuals who are on the path to becoming, you know, homegrown terrorists, is the bottom line. We need to look at all of our resources. And mental health has been continually an issue that people have brought up. But if they've never been diagnosed, or, you know, these are people that live by themselves, that's always going to be hard to determine. Now, with these limited options available in law enforcement, if no crime has occurred and a possibility that other community resources can help, we need to answer three important questions. And they're very simple. How can potential homegrown violent extremists be more effectively identified before an attack takes place? Law enforcement is always working on that. They're not just sitting by idly. They're working on that. It'll take time. Now, next question. Can the framework of a multidisciplinary team evaluations be used to identify individuals who are more likely to commit extremism expired? Violence. Now think about that for a moment. How can we identify these individuals who might commit these things? We can't. That's very, very difficult. Then, of course, the third, once these individuals are identified, should preventative civil detention be used to mandate participation in countering violent extremism? Listen, think about that logically. You start putting these people in some detention center because you think about what they might do. That's going to be problematic. You know, plaintiff attorneys and criminal law attorneys are going to be all over this particular situation. They're going to be all over this because they're going to be talking about the person's constitutional rights, et cetera, and their rights are being trampled on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, look, it's tough. Did I miss one? We have to understand that law enforcement is doing their best. Period. And with that in mind, give them a chance, but more importantly, work with them. I think I may have missed a call here. I'm not sure. If the caller is still out there and listening, call back in. I may have missed it. But at any rate, look, the growing concern is that individuals in the United States can become radicalized and pose a nearly, you know, a threat that law enforcement, even through analysis and public officials, they got to establish protocols to detect these warning signs of violent extremism or potential acts of terror. Now, once such a threat is identified, the ideal response is action and to disrupt the threat before anyone is hurt. Because I'm going to tell you, federal, state, and law and local law enforcement efforts have certainly succeeded in stopping many attacks. You don't even know all the attacks sometimes. You know. So you the news only will give you, you know, a limited amount on this. Now, understand, when we stop, how do I put this? We can't just stomp on people's rights. If we stomp on their rights, they're going to get out. And that's not what we want. That's kind of like the book, when I wrote my book, Right to Counsel. You have to keep the emotion out of some of this. I understand these are very emotional issues, but you got to keep the emotions out. If you don't do that, and these people are arrested too soon, or while they're arrested because it's an emotional issue about what they've done, then the other side of the coin is they're going to get off. And now we're back to square one. Now, look at it this way. Once an attack has taken place, agencies responsible for investigating the crime have an incredible array of resources to establish a timeline, motive, and evidence for the prosecution of any surviving perpetrators. Now, remember, a lot of these guys, they end up taking their own lives. So we don't all get to see or to find out why they even did what they did. That's the deal. Now, criminal investigations often uncover warning signs that could have been overlooked. They can't see it all. Moreover, in hindsight, some opportunities for intervention were not seized in time because the activity, you know, of the would-be perpetrator did not rise to a level of probable cause. Probable cause, you guys, is, I'm sure some of you have heard probable cause. The issue of probable cause, you know, is when law enforcement has a reason to believe that something is going on. I'm trying to keep it as simple as possible. Now, think about the fact that criminal investigations sometimes do uncover warning signs, and it can be overlooked. In hindsight, some opportunities did not rise to that level, and missed opportunities are always going to be there. And that's a shame, because sometimes as a result of that, somebody may have been killed. Now, existing criminal laws are designed to combat terrorism and violent extremism are wide and varied. Some of these are on a state level, some of these are on a federal level. Many of these laws can establish probable cause for arrest for terrorist suspects who exhibit evidence of conspiracy to commit. See, conspiracy is a whole separate kind by itself. That's when one or more persons get together that they're going to commit a crime. Now, that's a crime in itself. Now, look, it's not one that's going to put them in jail forever, but at least if we have that, it gives us a reasonable idea. It may give them a reason to be able to arrest a person and get them off the streets. Now, the other thing that you have to understand is that getting material to support the evidence is important also. Now, in addition to arrest and prosecution, response to terrorism, homegrown violent extremism requires a method to evaluate the threat level of non-criminal but potentially dangerous individuals who become known to authorities prior to an attack. Once identified, these individuals may be directed toward a growing list of national, state, and local resources that are engaged in countering violent extremism. So look, this just gives you a rough idea about what I'm talking about. The homegrown radicalization of some of these individuals and these homegrown terrorists, the biggest issues for some of this, quite frankly, they're coming off the internet. They're learning things from the news, newspapers, articles people write. That's hard. I mean, and I'm not just talking about adults for this. I'm talking about children as well. And you've heard me, for those of you that are regular listeners, I'm always talking about the fact that these children need to be monitored a little bit more closely these days. And I know how it is. I raise boys myself. These guys, you know, they don't want you treading on their rights as if they have any when they're living in the house. Don't get me wrong. Don't send me any hate mail. But let's face it, the realities are, is that when they live in your house, they got to do as you do. We all get that. And these teenagers are going to rear up, you know, and, you know, want to start talking about how you violating their rights as if they have. Well, they do have certain rights, and that's the right against abuse. But to me, you know, anything other than that's fair game. So we understand that. And now with technology, with these kids having passwords and listen, parents, you need to get those passwords and to be able to get in there and see exactly what's going on with some of these individuals. Okay, well, look, that was the area that I wanted to do and to cover for, you know, for detecting and disrupting homegrown violent extremism. I wanted to at least give you a better flavor to understand what law enforcement is doing, what we have to do. The different avenues that are out there. Mental health is a big issue, as I stated. But, you know, just understand law enforcement can't do it all. Okay, now let's turn to what I kind of feel is the main subject area for today. We start looking at this business about capital punishment in the United States. Now, I was a history major in college, so some of this, you know, I kind of remember back from the day. But just to let you know, capital punishment is simply a legal penalty. And believe it or not, it's only used by 30 states and the federal government. And believe it or not, the military as well. Now, to be honest with you, its existence can be traced back to the beginning of the American colonies. The United States is the only Western country currently applying the death penalty. And is one of 54 countries worldwide applying it, and was the first to develop lethal injection as a method of execution, which we'll talk about, which has since been adopted, to be honest with you, by five other countries. Now, when we talk about this, I just want to let you know, as of April 1st of this year, there are 2,743 inmates on death row. That's a lot. 2,743. Now, let's back up in time a little bit here. The first recorded death sentence in the British North American colonies, what year do you think it was carried out? I'll give you a moment on that. Don't be looking it up on your internet or your phone. I'm going to make it easy for you. Believe it or not, the first execution was in 1608. And the person that was killed was Captain George Kendall. He was executed by firing squad at the Jamestown Colony. Now, we've always heard about Jamestown. So, and he was executed for spying for the Spanish government. 1608. That's a long time ago. And Jamestown, as you know, was the first colony founded. So we started with this death penalty from almost day one of the birth of our country, so to speak. Now, there was the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights was adopted in 1789. I'm taking you guys back to your high school history days on some of this. You know, I'm sure half of you out there listening were probably asleep during history. You know, don't remember it. History was my favorite. But at any rate, the Bill of Rights, as a reminder, 1789, it included the Eighth Amendment. Now, that prohibited what we call cruel and unusual punishment. Cruel and unusual punishment. And that's always what the issue is going to be, is that whether or not this business about the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment. And of course, then is what comes up is the method that gets used for the execution. So then a lot of times what gets argued by the criminal law attorneys that are representing or the public defenders that are representing is that the method itself is what's cruel and unusual punishment. So therefore, it violates the Eighth Amendment. So you cannot do it. Cannot do it. So, hey, I'll tell you, some people don't know, I'm sure a lot of you don't know this, the year of the first execution by the electric chair. You ready? 1890. That's how far back it goes. They went to the electric chair, by the way, because they thought that was more humane than hanging a person. And I'll talk about some of the different things, the different methods that they actually have used for the death penalty. And you'll see why this issue of the cruel and unusual punishment arguments are always made. Now, I told you 1608 was when it first started. Let me tell you something. Capital punishment wasn't suspended until 1972. That's a long time. So from 1972, but it was reinstated. What year? You guys remember? Well, some of you might be too young to remember, so I'll tell you. 1976. So for 4 years, capital punishment was suspended. Now, I will tell you this. There are states that have abolished the death penalty. Now, I will go through that list for you real quick. Alaska, they got rid of it in 1957. Connecticut, 2012. Delaware, 2016. District of Columbia, 1981. Hawaii, 1957. Illinois, 2011. Iowa, 1965. Maine, 1887. Maryland, 2013. Massachusetts, 1984. Michigan, 1846. They got rid of it a long time ago. Minnesota, 1911. Jersey, 2007. New Mexico, 2009. New York, 2007. New Mexico, 2009. North Dakota, 1975. Rhode Island, 1984. Puerto Rico, 1929. Vermont, 1972. Washington, the state of Washington, they got rid of it this year, 2018. West Virginia, 1965, and Wisconsin, 1853. So you can see that some of these states have been against it for a very, very long time. So, you know, a lot of those individuals, they'll get death penalty. Excuse me, they won't get the death penalty, but they'll get life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And quite frankly, I think, you know, I'm not trying to get into a political argument about this, but, it, you know, some of the arguments are always that the pros and cons is that it deters people from killing each other, basically. That's always the big argument. Now, I will tell you that throughout the years, because of the arguments about the cruel and unusual punishment, the issue of lethal injection came up. Now, from 1976, because I told you that's when it was reinstated, to July of this year, there were 1,477 executions. And to be honest with you, somebody was, since July actually, there's been one or two since even July, so that number's even higher. Now, I will tell you, out of that 1,477 number, 1,302 were by lethal injection, 158 by electrocution, 11 by gas, 3 by hanging, and are you ready for this one? 3 by firing squad. Yeah, you know, and I was a little surprised about that one. Now, I remember a few years back, I think in Utah, there was a guy who elected to be executed by firing squad. And I think he was the same one that was involved in the Oklahoma. I'm trying to remember if he was the one with the Oklahoma bombing with Timothy McVeigh. I think he may have been. But at any rate, because there was a lot of people actually volunteering to be the ones to pull the trigger. And yes, there are people out there that do not mind being the ones to see the execution through to its completion. Now, where do you think the most of these executions have taken place? North, south, east, or west? I will tell you, the south had the great majority of these executions with 1,207. There were 181 in the Midwest, 85 in the west, and only 4 in the northeast. Only 4. Yeah, it's not very many. But I will tell you, no state in the Northeast has conducted an execution since Connecticut way back in 2005. Now, I will tell you one state, and I'm getting ready to give you some information on this particular state, and I mentioned the state earlier. But the state of Texas alone conducted 552 executions between that time frame that I gave you, 1976 and 2018. And I will give you some other numbers for 2018 in a little bit. Now, Virginia and Oklahoma combined together to do 777 of those executions. And also, just to let you know, because I mentioned about the federal government earlier, three executions have been conducted by the federal government. And the last one of those was in 2003. So, yeah. Now, between 1999 and since that time, the number of executions have actually decreased. And that could be for a lot of different reasons. Now, I know we got the death penalty in California, but it's been a while since anybody has been executed in California. And that's, you know, the arguments over the lethal injection, the arguments over, you know, the protocols, and I'm going to be talking about that shortly as well, have been factors for sure. At any rate, look, if you got any comments or questions, give me a call at 818-602-4929. And again, you can always email me at listenupwithjp@pottsandassociates.com. All right? At any rate, moving right along with this. Now, California at one time had also suspended the execution. That's how Charles Manson ended up not getting executed for what he did in the Manson family, because the California Supreme Court had suspended, I think I mentioned that in one of the prior shows, had actually suspended the death penalty, and that's how he ended up getting off without being executed. Now, the issue that comes up has to do with lethal injection. Now, look, Barbara, when she sent me the email, said that it's inhumane and barbaric. And I get that. I do understand that. But is what they sought to do with these executions is to make them a little bit more humane. Now, I understand the concept of killing an individual for having committed, you know, the crime of murder, whatever the case may be. That in itself, some people will argue, it's not the method, it's the fact that it's being done. So no matter how you're doing it, it's still wrong. I get that. But let me just tell you, hanging, all right, was really, really very brutal. So that's why is what they switched to was the electrocution, you know, by the electric chair. Now, here's what's interesting. I told you earlier about the first execution by the electric chair. It was actually in the state of New York, who now doesn't even have the death penalty anymore. Now, the reason why New York had it was because of the fact that they thought hanging was too barbaric. So they wanted to get away from the hanging, and they actually came up with the electric chair. Now, this business about lethal injection was to make it, Barbara, more humane. You know, it's supposed to be a quiet way of doing it. So they're not being electrocuted. They're not being, you know, violently hung by the neck until dead. Lethal injection was actually created by a Julius Mount Blair. And it was used as a cheap alternative for hanging. And believe it or not, and I hate to bring this up because here comes the politics into this, it was actually first used by the Nazis, and they were using it just to kill people. So, you know, I hate to say that this is something that, in terms of where the concept came from, had to come out of Nazi Germany, but apparently he was the first one, and that's where it came up. Now, the format which prisons are being executed, though, is changing. Now, keep in mind, in America and a growing number of other countries, the lethal injection has become now the most commonly used form of capital punishment. It does replace other forms, such as the hanging, electric chair as well. And I think that we all should think about it in terms of it being humane and a method to do it, if we're going to have it. Now, I think on one of the other shows I did mention that I don't believe in the death penalty, so don't send me any hate mail. I don't believe in the death penalty for a murder. A person commits one murder. I think that anybody, unfortunately, can make that kind of mistake. It's not good, but it's still something that I think that people can do. But I think in terms of multiple murders, when you have these crime sprees, so to speak, and this wanton disregard for human life, and people just mow people down and shoot people down, they don't have a conscience, in my opinion. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to pay my tax dollars for them to live out their lives, you know, forever and a day on my dime, you know. And you think about the families that are out there that suffer as a result of this. Now, I'm going to tell you the crimes of rape, torture, treason, kidnapping, murder, and perjury. there's a moral code associated with those, you know, as well. And you got to understand that communities would plunge into anarchy if we didn't have some kind of system in place in order to be able to deter certain kinds of crimes. And at one time, I can tell you, for rape and torture, they got the death penalty. There's no doubt about it. And again, I already told you, that's, you know, a lot of that was happening in the South. And I do think for those crimes now no longer can you be, that would be cruel and unusual punishment for the act of rape to be given death penalty. So that particular crime is no longer there. And it basically just has to do with, if you think about it, with murder. And murder can happen any kind of different ways. It can happen during the commission of an inherently dangerous felony, such as burglary, robbery, etc. So that does change things. Now, there's an argument that the death penalty has been abused. And that has to do with the procedures. Now, the administrators, you know, may vary the dosage or exposure levels of these things. And some people are out there doing it to gain information on the body's reaction to certain extreme forms of stimulation. You know, doctors who are responsible for executions may not meet the same rigorous standards meant by the majority of doctors, since the American Medical Association. It actually discourages its members from participating in executions. If you remember, that was one of the big issues that they had in California. Because in California, there was an individual who was going to be executed, but then they couldn't find, and this wasn't under Jerry Brown, they were going to execute an individual, but they couldn't find any doctors that were going to do it because it violated their oath. So they actually had to, you know, I guess cancel the execution. I think eventually the same individual was eventually executed because they found somebody that was willing to do it. And I guess if you look hard enough, you're always going to find somebody that's going to do it. Now, the arguments that they make on lethal injection, well, you have to understand the process. The first one is like what they call sodium pentothal. And then it's like three different technical long, you know, scientific names of doctors, you know, what these doctors give all of these things. Nobody can understand them but doctors. But the first protocol is like a barbiturate. And the purpose of it is loss of consciousness. So what they do basically is knock you out. It makes the brain cells stop reacting to nerve impulse and puts the inmate to sleep. That's supposed to be the first injection, the first protocol. He's quietly sleeping. All right. Now, that sounds humane to me, Barbara. All right. I understand from the standpoint it's still the same thing, but I'm just saying we talk about trying to be humane. And then the second one is a derivative of curare. Now, if you know curare, we've seen that in the movies, I'm sure, which is used as a poison, the poison of the arrows in the Amazon. Remember the curare? They put it on the tips of the arrows and they would shoot it. And the purpose was to have like a respiratory arrest. It paralyzes muscles, basically, used in breathing. So the lungs stop putting oxygen into the red blood cells. So now you're putting the person asleep, and now you're paralyzing the muscles is what they're doing. And then the last one is like a potassium chloride, they call it, which is a simple chemical salt purpose, a chemical salt of sorts. And that creates cardiac arrest because it blocks the electric signals inside the heart. So the heart slows down and then eventually stops. Now, the argument, now, when you think about that, that's what they say was a three-step protocol. Now, the United States Supreme Court has dealt with this issue on the lethal injection, and they're always arguing the same thing out there, and that is the fact that this three-step protocol is not proper. They've argued that putting, you know, animals to sleep, as an example, and doing this, they were trying to make the last time they made an argument to the Supreme Court on this issue was that, you know, the veterinarians, I think, or more, they mentioned veterinarians, and putting animals to sleep was a almost like a better system of sorts. Now, In 2006, to give you an example, the state of Missouri halted all executions for fear of causing an unacceptable risk of pain. So the issue that they always have is that, first of all, the first one that's supposed to put the people asleep doesn't actually put them asleep. They're not sleeping enough, and they could experience pain, even though they're not conscious enough to let you know that there's some pain. I remember a couple of years back, Justice Roberts, I believe it was, who said, whoever said there wasn't, you know, or maybe it was Justice Scalia, actually, rest in peace. But Scalia actually was the one who said, whoever said there wasn't supposed to be pain with an execution. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but some people would argue there's some validity to that statement. But in 2006, the state of Missouri halted it. Unacceptable risk of pain. And, you know, roughly 50% has been argued of those executed could have been conscious before the final drug had actually been administered. So, look, you know, there's always going to be these arguments. And, you know, I appreciate that. But, you know, for me, I also go back to, what about the individuals whose lives were snuffed out by these people? That, to me, is a factor also. What about the families that are not going to have the love and the comfort anymore because this person has taken, that, you know, their loved one's life? Now, I'm going to give you a little bit more history here. Because when we think about the death penalty, we always think about men. Men. But I'm going to tell you something. I told you the first execution was in 1608. Hey, in 1632, and that would have been 24 years approximately after the first recorded male execution, Jane Champion became the first woman known, she's the first woman known to have lawfully been executed. And she was sentenced to death by hanging after she was convicted of infanticide. Do you know what that is? For killing her own child. Around two-thirds of women executed in the 17th century and early centuries were convicted of child murder, believe it or not. Yeah. Yeah. Two-thirds of the women, 17th and 18th centuries, executed for killing their own children. I mean, that was amazing to me when I found that stat. Now, the second half of the 17th century saw the executions of 14 women and 6 men who were accused of witchcraft. Now, I'm sure you remember seeing some of this on, you know, movies, etc. It was during the witch hunt hysteria and the Salem witch trials. While both men and women were executed, 80% of the accusations were toward women. So the list of executions were disproportionately. Yeah. Now, I will tell you, because, again, this is an area people don't realize about women being executed, but there's been some notable female executions. And look this one up. Mary Surratt, Margie Velmer Barfield, and Wanda Jean Allen. Now, Mary Surratt, does that name sound familiar to you? She was executed by hanging in 1865. What happened in 1865, folks? Here we go back to the history class that you were sleeping during. The Lincoln assassination. She was hung after being convicted of co-conspiring to assassinate Abraham Lincoln. Now, Margie Velen Barfield was convicted of murder, and she was executed by lethal injection in 1984. She actually became the first woman to be executed since the ban on capital punishment was lifted in 1976. And this other lady that was executed, Wanda Jean Allen, she was convicted of murder in 1989. She had a high-profile execution by lethal injection in January of 2001. And the reason why it was a high-profile execution? She was the first black woman to be executed in the United States since 1954. Yep. Yep. So that was an interesting stat. Now, juvenile capital punishment. You want to know the first year? 1642. 1640. They didn't play around back in those days. That was Virginia, by the way. But 1642, the first ever juvenile's name was Thomas Grounder. He was actually sentenced to death. Oh, actually, you know what? Let me correct that. He was actually executed in Massachusetts. And the reason why, you ready for this one? Bestiality. Bestiality is what he was executed for. Now, you're going to tell me, what the heck is that? I'm not going to tell you about that on the air. You're going to have to look that one up, bestiality. All right? Ever since then, 361 other juveniles have been sentenced to death, all right, given the death penalty. But in 1987, the Supreme Court turned around and felt that executing juveniles would violate the Eighth Amendment, a cruel and unusual punishment. So it was abolished in the United States. And I don't know. I don't think that's a bad thing. There's a number of juveniles that are actually in. They're not on death row anymore, but that are on life sentences for murder. And you remember when I talked about the kids who kill? I told you about some of them that, in fact, are on, you know, in prison, incarcerated for the rest of their lives, basically, while others in other states actually got off. Now, I want to give you some other information here, because in 2018, there's actually been 25 executions. Somebody asked me, when was the last time? I said, you don't hear about this. I mean, this is November. This is 11 months. In 11 months, there's actually been 25 executions. And it's what I want to share with you are some of the states. Some of the states. Now, these are in, to be honest with you, it's literally every single month of this year, there's been an execution. And I will tell you, the leading state for executions, Texas. I'm telling you right now, if you're going to kill somebody, I'm not encouraging that. Don't do it in Texas, because you will suffer the ultimate consequence, no doubt about it. But this year, they've had 14. No, I take that back. Actually, my count is 15 for this year for them. And let me just tell you, here's the deal. Out of that 15, they had 15 in Texas, one in Florida, one in Alabama, two in Georgia, one in Ohio, one in Nebraska, one in South Dakota, and three in Tennessee. Now, here's the other news. Out of that group of 25, 14 were Caucasian, 7 were black, and 4 were Hispanic. 14, 7, and 4. Now, the age was kind of interesting for me also, because there was an average age. The average ages of these individuals were from 50 to 69. And I will tell you what day of the week appears to be the day that most of these were executed. Thursdays. So I know around the prisons, boy, on Thursday, everybody gets nervous, but that's the main day there for some reason. It's been other days of the week, obviously. But yeah, and like I said, there's no particular month, because it appears that all of the months have had executions. And the youngest one executed was 26 years of age. 26 years of age was the youngest. So, and I'm just trying to read through my list here real quick. Yeah. You know, the appeal process, just to give you an idea for some of these individuals, one of these appeals, 33 years before the person was executed. Another one, 39 years was the appeal process. It's a long time. That's a long appeal process. And by the way, these were all males this year too. So just to let you know, there was no women executed this year. All right. Now, let me just finish this up by telling you, I know that this is a very sensitive area for people. The death penalty, I don't know. I don't see it disappearing anytime soon, to be perfectly honest with you. It's going to be there. The arguments, the United States Supreme Court on this lethal injection argument that had been made, I think they're just about done with it. They've said they've dealt with this issue, whether or not the death penalty violates the Eighth Amendment. They're pretty consistent in the fact that they feel that it doesn't. So that's why the issue of the protocols have come up. And I think, as I recall, the justices even said that, look, eliminate one of the steps or something, and then there's no argument that has to be made anymore because about this issue of pain, I think, or something of that nature. But at any rate, I don't know. We'll see. You know how it is. It's all political. Let me close out by saying you've been listening to Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. If you like what you heard, do me a favor, spread the word. Until then, I really honestly want you to be safe. Now, I'm going to close with one other thing this week. If you wanted to be apprised of the upcoming topics on the show, you can text Potts & Associates to 22828 and then enter your email address. Text Potts & Associates, P-O-T-T-S, Associates, T-O, 22828, and enter your email address. So text Potts Associates to 22828 and then enter your email, and you will be notified about the topics on the upcoming show and being able to get that reminder. All right. Hey, thanks again for listening. I really appreciate it, and I will talk to you next week.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.